Colonel Sarpoutel, your reel 2. When you were doing these briefings, were there any special problems that you had with getting your message across to the personnel?
Yes, not so much with, dare I use the expression, the rank and file, the honest soldier or marine or sailor. But there was quite a difficulty with the officers, and certainly people talking to people back in England before I left and by signal afterwards. And they simply, I may be wrong, but I certainly had the impression at the time, and it's remained with me ever since, they simply couldn't really understand that because the Falkland Islands were the same latitude south as Great Britain was north, give or take a mile or two, it wasn't a typical piece of northwest, and there'll be hedgerows and trees and streams and cover and long grass and all that sort of thing. They knew it was a reasonably windy place. And I found that a difficult thing to get across. The other thing I found difficult, a part of that, is that an army marches obviously on its stomach, but and it relies a large part on living off the land, what it can find, or you know, if you're marching across Germany, you'll steal from the, you know, if there's a war, you'd take care of the supermarkets. I mean, there's always food somewhere. And I couldn't really get it across to people to begin with that there wasn't any food. There were no great settlements. Where there were settlements, they would see a map and they think, oh, there's a village. They're not called villages, of course. But I had to explain time and time again, many of these settlements were one man. A man, his wife, and a dog. Perhaps a man, his wife, a dog, and a couple of farmhands. And there were no great supplies. There were no great sort of civilization running down the tracks. There were no roads. And although you could tell people all this, it was very difficult for people to realize that once we landed, every single drop of water and mouthful of food had to be brought in. And actually, of course, I emphasize this, that the Argentinian army would be having a great deal of difficulty. And they could only be supplied by air if we had this total exclusion zone. And the best thing we could do would be to stop the aircraft supplying them, because the aircraft would have to supply them every single day. And of course they did, and sadly they were never stopped. And I think on the last night before the surrender, in the end, 14 Hercules flew into Stanley. I wouldn't like to be quoted on that, but certainly a large number. I mean, it was 7 or 40. I mean, it was a large number. And I did warn people that they would be bringing in, one of them brought in firewood. There wasn't water for all these guys. I mean, Stanley hardly has enough water for its own population. There was certainly hardly enough food, particularly if you stop the civilian resupply routes in. And so this was a problem that was going to face us. It was certainly going to face the Argentinians, and we could make it better for us by making sure that the Argentinians could get no resupply. Sadly, I didn't think Admiral Woodward took it quite so seriously, because he should really have gone hell for leather to stop those Argentinian, the Hercules flights. Bad enough the aircraft, the fighters getting in. And I didn't think that point was ever really hoisted by some people, at least not until it was too late.
What did you hope to do once you got there?
I didn't actually give, to begin with, I didn't give what was going to happen after we landed a great deal of thought. All my efforts had gone into telling people what to do so they could make their own plans. Although it became quite clear that once we were denied the use of helicopters for the initial assault, the first D-Day was going to be a landing craft bonanza. And as I was the professional head of the landing craft branch by then, I then became more and more involved in the landings, in the planning and opinions and discussions. Because really once we had settled on 3 places, of which San Carlos was the prime candidate, there was no point in my sort of hiding behind sort of objectivity or subjectivity, consciences, if you see what I mean. I was then involved, and so once I accepted the fact it was San Carlos, I then, as it were, changed gear and became a key member of the planning team. As up to then, of course, I hadn't been; I'd just been an advisor. And so it was my job, really, to then plan the landings. The orders were that we would land in San Carlos in various waves, depending on the number of landing craft and the number of beaches, which I'd obviously chosen. I then became a perfectly normal member of the planning team, with a view to leading the landings, the landing craft assault, which is what I did on 21st of May. And that was right and proper. I mean, I was the senior landing craft officer in the Royal Marines. We had 9/10 of the landing craft branch of the Royal Marines down there. And I also professionally and privately wanted to do it because of my love affair with the islands. So it was a great joy to me to lead the landings and lead the way down St. Carlos in the first boat onto the beach, which was with two para.
What was the main problem you had in the planning of the landing?
Oh, no problems. Perfectly straightforward. Been doing it for years and years and years, all my life, all my service career, which then was, what, 20-odd years. It was... I hate to say it was absolutely straightforward. There was no problem. Well, yes, okay, there was a problem, because we didn't have the right ships. I mean, if we'd had the right ships, you know, a commando goes to war in a ship from which it will land with its own organic landing craft. But because of successive defence cuts, of course, commanders had to go to, and parachute battalions had to go to war in civilian cruise liners. And so then had to cross deck this awful, awful business. Awful word, too. But they had to cross deck before the landing, which tends to give away surprise and secrecy and flexibility of landing options. So they could get into ships from where they could then land from landing craft. And in some cases, some people had to go from one ship to another ship where there were no landing craft, and landing craft had to come from another ship to that ship to take them ashore. But that wasn't a problem in so much. It was an embuggerance, and it was a nuisance, and it destroys some of the great beauties of amphibious warfare, which is the surprise, the flexibility, and the choice open to you right up until the last minute. But apart from being an irritation, and an irritation brought about by inept defence policies, apart from that, it was a perfectly straightforward planning problem as far as the actual landings were concerned. Once I'd got everybody embarked in the ships, and my plan was, we were actually an hour late because there was a nonsense getting two para into some of the landing craft, and through no fault of two paras, nor indeed of the ships. It was just a function of going to war on the wrong ships. It's like sending the parachute battalion to war in 50 Cessna aircraft. You know, it's a farce. But once we'd got everybody afloat, an hour late, I abandoned my original beautifully timed plans of running down at two-thirds speed down a set course, which I had planned with meticulous accuracy, because I am a navigator. Skirting the kelp, I reckon there would be no mines. By the time we crossed the start line, or what would be in the landing craft branch called the line of departure, the LOD, which is the north-south line, in this case between Chancho Point and Fanning's Head, I threw the timings to the wind and said, right, full speed, straight down the middle. And if there were mines, sod it, frankly. Because we had to make up time, timing being important, because, of course, it ties in with SBS, naval gunfire, all that sort of thing. So we went straight down the middle. There were no mines, and we landed in the end just 45 minutes late, which is annoying because we should have landed on time. But it was the right beach, which is actually probably the most important aspect. The second wave, well, we were all the first wave, but the second half of that wave landed on the other beach, which was 40 commando, to a pre-planned arrangement. I then collected the landing craft back together, went back, and I collected three para and took them into the Port St. Carlos beach, Sand Bay Beach, it's called. And that wasn't... it was the one beach that I'd... Although I described in, I think, reasonably accurate detail, I'd never actually landed on. So a lot of it was guesswork. I mean, intelligent guesswork, knowing the way the beaches are and the topography. But, of course, without actual soundings, I couldn't guarantee you would get a dry landing. A dry landing isn't the be-all and end-all, certainly not in temperate climates, but you don't want to land people with wet feet. It sounds a bit wet at the moment, sorry, a bit sort of pansy, but not in these conditions when they were going to be wet for 3 weeks and open trench foot. So we really were quite keen to give everybody a dry landing, but things didn't work out like that. We knew they weren't going to get dry landings elsewhere. I was hoping they might have done it at Sand Bay Beach. But actually they were going to be wet up to their middles. Well, getting wet up to your knees is one thing, but getting wet up to your waist is something totally different. So there was a last-minute delay while we shuffled men ashore. If we'd been under attack, they would have got ashore instantly. I might even have driven the landing craft so hard that they would have been damaged, anything to get the men ashore. But we weren't under attack, so we shuffled the three pair ashore in the smaller landing craft, and they got ashore dry. So that really, that was D-Day. Well, I mean, D-Day didn't end there, but I then went back and debriefed the Brigadier and the Commodore. Later on that day, I think I towed in HMS Argonaut, who had been damaged by two bombs, one in her engine room, one in the forward Sea Cat magazine. It was an interesting day, but it wasn't a complicated day. It was an irritating day, purely and simply because we were the wrong ships for the job. But fine, we'd planned for that.
And then, what was your role after the landing had taken place?
Well, I was sort of staff officer without portfolio, except I didn't describe myself as a staff officer. I was really just required on call to do anything, offload the ships, tow in Argonaut, rescue survivors from Antelope, take in special forces patrols or plan for it. Because the ships are sailing out quite often at night, it was easier for the planning of the offload to take place from a headquarters ashore. So I set up a headquarters ashore and would be given the planning priorities for that night, depending on what ships were coming in and what was required ashore. And I would then juggle the landing craft to meet those offload priorities. And that was it, really, until we started moving to Bluff Cove, which is a totally different story. And again, I won't bore with the details. They're all in my book, and it's a long, complicated thing, which I'd get wrong anyway in an interview like this without all my notes, because there was so much dovetailing of different and, at the time, unknown and unconnected, seemingly unconnected events, which actually, in the end, all were connected. But in the end, I was required to take the Scots Guards to Bluff Cove in HMS Intrepid. The night was the 6th of June. And there was all sorts of things before that, actually. I'd planned with H. Jones the move of two para up Brenton Loch for him to do the attack on Darwin and Goose Green by sea from the west up the top end of Brenton Loch. But I couldn't give him very good odds, and I felt rather weak about it, but I felt I couldn't give him any stronger odds. And when he coupled that with the odds that he reckoned of him winning the battle anyway, he decided it was going to be better in his favour if he walked. So he walked. I think in the end, although I've often thought about it, although I blame myself for not being very bold, I did discover that the beaches were mined, and the approach from that angle was mined on the land. So I think it might have been a bloodier affair than the route that he took, but I don't know. I mean, who knows?
How intensive was the mining?
I don't know, but I know that there were mines. The other thing that worried us at the time, which unfortunately worried us at the time because it turned out to be a false alarm, was the thought of a lot of Amtraks scurrying around defending Goose Green and Darwin, and the thought of being at sea if we'd been stranded, because it's a very, very difficult navigational passage through waters very poorly charted. And my own charts were the most up-to-date. But even there, I knew it didn't chart all the rocks and underwater obstructions. And I had terrible visions of stranding a craft with 120 paras in it at daybreak with the Bakara airstrip half a mile away. And the Amtraks able to knock us to bits. So I was quite unhappy about it. And coupled with the thought of the mines on the beach for him, he eventually decided that he would walk, so he walked. So that was that. And then there was this move of the Scots Guards, which was, to me, if ever I was unhappy or miserable, I mean, one can be frightened and not miserable, But if I was ever really unhappy and miserable in the sort of emotional sense about what I was being asked to do, it was the move of the Scots Guards, because I was told that we'd be dropped about a mile, about an hour and a half from Bluff Cove. In the end, we were actually dropped about 7 hours, because the captain of Intrepid wouldn't take me any closer, and certainly not as close as he'd been told to take me by the Commodore. And I had a terrible row with him, just the two of us together in his chart house. And I thought, frankly, he was behaving, let me put it politely, rather timidly. And I certainly was behaving rather timidly, frankly. But anyway, he wouldn't drop me any closer, and I argued that his argument was that he didn't want to lose his ship from an exocet. And I said, well, frankly, bugger that. The loss of your ship isn't actually going to be that important compared with the loss of 600 men in the Scots Guards. Because you are launching us, I said, 7 miles, I think. I mean, I didn't actually know where he was going to launch us. I didn't know when he launched us, where he had launched us, until I closed the coastline and recognised it, which was disgraceful. But I reckon anyway the 600 men of the Scots Guards deserved better treatment. But he wasn't prepared to risk his ship, and I had to launch the whole battalion in 4 unarmed, unarmoured, open landing craft in the open sea with a 7-hour approach past enemy-held territory, with the possibility that there were some enemy ships, because I was told that there were no British ships on the gun line that night. And yet I knew there were two enemy patrol vessels still unaccounted for, or at least that's what I thought at the time. They didn't tell me that they'd both been accounted for, which might have alleviated some of my worry. And when we were launched, I hadn't the slightest idea where we were, so I headed northeast, having a pretty good idea we were west of Lively Island, and it turned out we were west of Lively Island, which gave me a hideous problem, because I had no charts, I only had my memory. The only chart I had was, odd enough, this chart, which is a very, what's the scale of this thing, 1/1, I mean, it's a standard chart for the Falklands, which is, it's 1/2 to 5,000. Yeah, it's a tiny, tiny chart. And my memory. And I had to circumnavigate the whole of Lively Island, compass with a 30-degree error, no radar, and had to find Bluff Cove. So, and it wasn't a very happy occasion, really. And navigationally, we were pretty pushed. And as far as the military defence, we were pretty pushed. As it happened, we were bombed by something. There were lots of high explosives around us in the water, which didn't actually put us off terribly. There was nothing we could do about it, steaming at 7 knots, and with no defensive weapons offshore. And then we were approached by two ships. It turned out to be HMS Cardiff, but of course at the time, we'd been told there were no British ships going to be around by the captain of Intrepid, I assumed they were enemy. I assumed that they were these two patrol boats. Anyway, they told us to heave to, so we hove to. We tried to get out of the way, but frankly, it's 7 knots versus 30. You're not going to go very far. And I thought, if we can get inshore, if we get sunk, the men will have a shorter swim. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was beginning to blow up a bit by then, from the north. And anyway, the leading ship flashed us. Then, actually, she'd come to within about a mile or so. And I recognised her through my binoculars as being a British frigate. I didn't know which one. And she flashed one single word in Morse, little pinpoint red light, saying, friend. And I was so bloody angry, I sent back, to which side, rather hoping that they, because they were in the area, oh, just before, of course, this, I've forgotten to tell you, they fired 6 star shells over us. So if the enemy had been them bombing us earlier, or shelling us, they now certainly identified us as British landing craft. And could, of course, guess at our destination, because we were heading quite clearly towards Fitzroy or Bluff Cove. And so, and yet instead of staying to look after us, the two frigates, having didn't answer my rather rude reply to which side, they steamed off to the southeast at fast speed, leaving us militarily even more exposed, in my view, because the enemy would have seen that they were British, because we'd have obviously linked up with what they knew would be British frigates. And they, if they hadn't seen us anyway because of the star shells, well, that was a bit bad. And that was sad because Admiral Woodward had been told quite clearly by Michael Clapp that we were being sent through the area that night. And Admiral Woodward had himself told Michael Clapp that was fine because he will be putting no British frigates on the gun line. Well, he bloody well did. And he didn't tell his British frigates, who thought we were enemy. And, of course, he didn't tell us, who thought the British frigates were enemy. And I'm afraid that's a very personal mistake on the part of Admiral Woodward, and he should have known better. But anyway, come dawn, we found Bluff Cove, thank God. And I landed the Scots Guards, wet, cold, miserable, probably quite frightened after they'd suffered high explosives, then illumination, then frigates approaching at high speed in the dark off an enemy-held coastline, and finally 70-knot winds with driving rain and a very heavy sea and boats that are only designed to operate within 2 or 3 miles of their parent ship under radar control in sheltered waters. So that was quite interesting, and it was actually quite frightening, and I was actually quite miserable. Not miserable for myself or the comfort, although it was pretty uncomfortable, but miserable because I thought professionally the thing was a terrible cock-up. Fine, we got away with it, but I don't think you can praise success automatically. I think you have got to analyse success every bit as carefully as you analyse mistakes, because if something happens successfully through good luck, you cannot, or if you then plan it that way next time and the luck doesn't occur, you will be rightly held up to be a charlatan. So I've always analysed that experience more closely than I have analysed the rather more preventable accident that happened at Fitzroy. There wasn't an accident, but my goodness, we came really close to it on a number of occasions. And I think it was a little operation that deserves very careful study to see where deconfliction, to use that awful word, of making sure friendly forces know where friendly forces are. I think it's a very good lesson in that subject. Well, that was fine. When we got there, I was quite determined that the second night I wasn't going to suffer the same problem, so I managed to get a flight back to Fairless and Mike Clapp and told him in pretty stark language what had happened. And Mike, I'm a great admirer of Mike, and of course it wasn't his problem. He had expected the captain of Intrepid to drop us where Mike Clapp had told him to drop us. However, for the subsequent night, I was going to do the same thing with the Welsh Guards, but because all the landing craft were now at the far end, the ship, this time Fairless, was going to come to an RV, and I was going to come out with the landing craft, meet him, and bring the men in to Fitzroy, not to Bluff Cove. So that was all planned, and I flew back, got all that planned, got a list of the ships on the gun line, discovered the night recognition signals, which I hadn't been given the night before, and flew back very happy. Well, that was okay until I got back to find there were no landing craft. And despite my orders to remain at Bluff Cove, for me to come back with the orders for the night, which meant going out to collect to meet Fairless, who incidentally was coming to within two hours steaming of Bluff Cove. He's more of a bolder man than the captain of Fairless is a bolder man than the captain of Intrepid was. So there were no landing craft, and I assumed that they were all sheltering from the gale. And that was why, officially, I couldn't meet the Welsh Guards in Fairless. So when Fairless arrived at the RV and I wasn't there with the landing craft, she'd managed to sail two of her landing craft with Welsh Guards in them and returned empty, which is sad because, of course, we needed all the landing craft we could back at St. Carlos to continue the offloading. Well, I told everybody the reason why I hadn't met them was because of the gale and I couldn't get the boats out. Actually, at the time that I should have sailed to make the RV, it was reasonably calm. But I didn't admit to anybody at the time that the real reason why I didn't make it was that there were no boats. I subsequently discovered, and I now tell the story in full detail for the first time ever, that what had happened after I'd left Bluff Cove to fly back to get my briefing was that the parachute regiment officer called Chris Keeble had waved a pistol, ordered my boats to take his battalion to Bluff to Fitzroy. And they quite rightly had refused, saying, no, their orders from me, their boss, was to stay there until the night operation. Keeble produced his pistol, I am told, I wasn't there, but General Frost talks about it in his book, Two Para Falklands. And I think, much as I admire Chris Keeble, it was a disgraceful episode. So he hijacked the boats and got extremely angry when they couldn't find Fitzroy and ended up back in Bluff Cove. Well, they had no charts, the weather was marginal, and it was blowing again. In fact, it was beyond their limits. They'd never been to Fitzroy, and they were under orders to stay where they were, so I think it was a despicable performance. But because of that, they got to Fitzroy. It was then, the weather was too bad to sail from Fitzroy to meet me, to meet Fearless and the Welsh Guards. And that is why half the Welsh Guards got ashore, and the other half had to return to St. Carlos, and that's why that second half eventually ended up in Galahad when they were bombed. And there's no doubt in my mind that that is the sequence of events. However, there were other problems. When the Welsh Guards did turn up in Galahad at Fitzroy, wrongly, they should have got off if Two Para hadn't hijacked the boats. But anyway, they were there. Their mistake was not to get off. I can fully understand now why they didn't get off, although at the time I was extremely angry that they didn't take my word for it, or my orders. And they then did agree to get off, but unfortunately the land craft sent to collect them was hijacked by the commanding officer of the Field Ambulance Regiment, or Battalion, or whatever you call them. I'm not a very military person. Who saw the landing craft alongside to take the Welsh Guards ashore and thought that he, actually, being a lieutenant colonel, had a higher priority, so he ordered his men ashore first, which was wrong, because the landing craft had been sent to get the Welsh Guards ashore, who were needed. The parachute, the ambulance, were not needed. There was no war at that stage there. They could have waited on board for another 24 hours. But the battalion was needed, because it was two of the three fighting companies of the Welsh Guards who had to be up in the hills carrying out their recces and getting ready for the battles. But unfortunately, the CO of the parish of the ambulance brigade, ambulance, field ambulance, countermanded fire brigade's orders and my orders. So the Welsh Guards were still on board. Now, okay, they should have got off in the first place, but they were getting off. They'd agreed to get off. And they were still on board when, of course, the Skyhawks came in and bombed the ships. So, and I tell all that in one long story because it sort of leads from one bit into another. And I watched the bombing. I had gone ashore to persuade Fire Brigade, see if they had any influence over the officers on board Galahad, because I had failed to get them off. So that, unfortunately, is really how my part of the saga. I had tried to get the Welsh Guards off. But what I hadn't mentioned was that, of course, when they arrived in Galahad in Fitzroy, I'd gone across to find out who on earth they were, and had then discussed the problem and the air threat as I saw it. There were problems with the air threat, because although there should have been air cover overhead at Fitzroy that day, HMS Hermes had steamed another 100 miles further east to clean her boilers. Well, you would have thought it was a bloody stupid time of the war to go and clean boilers, and this was against the captain's wishes, but the flag officer, Woodward, had ordered the ship to go further. That meant that the cap aircraft overhead only had 10 to 15 minutes overhead at a time